Hello and welcome to the Juan on Juan podcast. If you're enjoying the show, consider signing up for the Patreon. There you get ad-free content, early access, exclusive episodes, and monthly supporter hangouts. You can find it at patreon.com/the Juan on Juan podcast. If you don't like the subscription-based models, there are other ways of supporting the show that are linked in the description. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this episode.
They said it was forbidden. They said it was dangerous. They were right. Introducing the paranoid American homunculus owner's manual. Dive into the arcane, into the hidden corners of the occult. This isn't just a comic. It's a hidden tome of supernatural power. All original artwork illustrating the groundbreaking research of Juan Ayala, one of the only living homunculologists of our time. Learn how to summon your own homunculus, an enigma wrapped in the fabric of reality itself, their power at your fingertips, their existence, your secret. Explore the mysteries of the Aristotelian, the spiritual, the Paracelsian, the Crowleyan homunculus, ancient knowledge lost to time, now unearthed in this forbidden tale. This comic book holds truths not meant for the light of day, knowledge that was buried, feared, and shunned. Are you ready to uncover the hidden, the paranoid American homunculus owner's manual, not for the faint of heart? Available now from Paranoid American. Get your copy at tjojp.com or paranoidamerican.com today.
Welcome to the Juan on Juan podcast with your host, Juan Ayala.
Some of these guys in the 90s, early 90s, like 1993, some of them, there was about 50 arsons, I think, recorded. The churches were built on sacred pagan land, and I think some of these people knew that, and they wanted to burn it because they believed it was part of the Northern Crusade, where, you know, Christianity came in to kill these people and call them savages. They kind of adopted their Viking imagery more, and then they got into Satanism as a way to give the middle finger. And then they get into the actual demonology. Some of these people get into demonology, both Semitic demonology and Nordic. There's bands that are getting into, that are very versed in Christianity and knowing about demonology and angels and stuff, like Gabriel, you know, all these names being mentioned of angels and stuff, like they're into that full mythos and also philosophy.
Welcome back to another episode of the Juan on Juan podcast. I'm your host, as always. Make sure to follow the show on social media at the Juan on Juan podcast on pretty much any major platform, tjojp.com. You can also call in 407-476-4606. Leave a message. Let me know what you thought of the episode, what you think of the show. Leave a five-star review wherever you're listening. If you're on YouTube, thumbs up, subscribe, all that good stuff. And joining us for the first and hopefully not the last time, a very special guest today. We have Wes Cage with us. Bro, welcome to the show, dude.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Appreciate you being here. Wes, can you let people know where they can find you? You told me you had your handle on Instagram. You have anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, aside from the at Weston Cage Coppola Instagram, there's a Linktree, and there's also a place called West Cage Emporium where I sell some of the audios that I make for people for wellness and certain benefits, and also like talismans and stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll send me the links and I'll put them in the description as well. Everyone, make sure to go check that out. And Wes, I mean, you're an interesting guy, actor, recording artist, music producer, mixed martial artist, you know, five languages. What can you tell us a little bit about you, Wes? Like what, tell us a little bit about you, man.
Well, I think I'm just a guy that got way too inspired by polymaths like Da Vinci and stuff at a young age. I've always wanted to do everything. I owe it to my family. You know, my parents really made sure that I had a lot of access to a lot of amazing experts and instructors and stuff. And there was always a Spanish guitar, piano, and an acoustic drum set in the house and a camera. So, of course, the camera led me to becoming a filmmaker with my friends and doing little films and directing them. And then all the instruments brought me to my music career. And then, of course, the martial arts, that daily discipline of that and stuff, you know, that acting school, that made me probably who I am today the most.
And I want to jump straight to the deep end. Where do you believe ideas come from, right? Because you have Weston, then you have Wes, right? You have the person, then you have the actor. Where do you think, right? Let's dive first into where do you believe ideas come from, right? Where do you think that they originate from? Are they, because it's interesting when you get an idea, and if you want to get into Plato, the theory of forms, these upper worlds and we're drawing from those worlds. In your opinion, where do ideas come from and where do you draw your inspiration from?
Well, I always believe that I try to draw my inspiration from source. You know, I believe that consciousness is light beyond photonic and electromagnetic light. I believe that that we're consciousness within consciousness. So I'm always trying to pull from a divine place. I know sometimes ideas will come from, you know, epiphanies and connections that we'll make based on our own memory and the data of our memory. But I do think there's a collective consciousness, and sometimes the Akashic records or there is a realm that can send us information. And I believe the creator does that. You know, my spirituality is first and foremost in my life. And I just got done writing about, you know, where that's taken me. It's introduced me to my soulmate, Melinda, my fiance, and, brought me to the path I was meant for. I mean, but I put actual discipline into my spirituality. So that's where I'm getting my ideas from mostly.
Yeah. I saw that you posted that you're writing about animism.
Yes. Yeah. That was the exact, writing I was thinking about.
Can you tell us a little bit about that for those that don't know what animism is?
Of course. Animism is just the belief that there's a spirit in all things. It's derived from the Latin and Italian word anima. Italian is definitely anima, meaning soul. And then it's interesting, though, just to see how potent that word is. If you look at anima, almost like a prefix as a word, the whole word being a prefix. You have animation, you have animism, you have, you know, all these things that come from that word. And it's basically believe that everything is an animated spirit. You know, most all living things for sure are. Some people believe that and areas have a spirit to them as well. But so I was getting into how that has to do with so much, you know, and I really believe, you know, just the mere fact that we have more neurons than there are stars in the galaxy and beyond, that just shows that we're like universes ourselves.
Yeah, because on my show, I talk a lot about the occult, a lot about the esoteric, a lot about alchemy, and right, the religion is in there too. And I was wondering, what are your thoughts about, and again, you don't have to answer this, but what are your thoughts about God? What do you think, the universe is God? Do you think, because you mentioned, right, there's this aspect of intelligent design when it comes to us. We have all these neurons. We are essentially a quantum computer. I mean, we're the best computer that there could possibly ever be. And it's like, I feel like a lot of people, especially nowadays, I mean, they're not tapping into their full potential that they could, they're not being the best versions they can be. Now we could talk about what's holding us back, technology being one of those, but what do you believe God is?
Well, I believe God is an omnipresent, infinite source of an intelligence beyond human sophistication. You know, the first emanation that ever occurred in existence. I mean, I believe that God is an architect. Just the fact that, you know, I believe spirit came first, but after that, you know, this whole universe that's infinite came from helium, hydrogen, and lithium. So clearly this being is scientific as well, and we have a scientific design, intelligent design, as you're saying, 100%. So it's like, I believe that God is a, I believe that there is a both male, female, God, goddess. That's why I call it God, goddess, but there is a force that basically is like an architect or grand geometer of the universe. But I also believe in many spirits connected to that source. And I think that there are, you know, I pray to multiple angels. I pray to multiple deities. Sometimes I pray to Gaia, just directly Mother Earth, because I think that gets overlooked a lot. Our responsibility as humans to protect the Earth and innocence and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm very, very spiritual. It's always been a part of my life. When I was a kid, I would always say the most spiritual stuff, and people would always ask, is he being told this stuff? And then they would say no, but also we encourage it. And then as I got older, I got into mysticism around 15, and I never stopped. I mean, now it's been 18 years of me studying this stuff, and it centers me. You know, some people freaks them out, numerology and all that stuff, or, you know, I see people saying that it's demonic to even read tarot cards and stuff, and it's just comical beliefs. But so I mean, I am very religious, but just with mysticism. And I think if someone's going for, be it, you know, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, you know, anything, that no matter where they go, that they just go to the top floor of that faith and really explore where it all becomes one, you know?
Yeah, faith is an interesting concept, because I was raised Pentecostal Christian, and I was always a bit of a black sheep, if you will, because I'd always ask the harder questions, the questions that they were uncomfortable to answer. And it's like, well, why are these books not in the canon, and et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, I cut my teeth on Gnosticism, so I can sort of answer some of these questions as far as animism, where even the Cathars, they believe that every single being was a light being trapped in a body, and therefore they wouldn't reproduce, so they didn't want to reproduce, because if they reproduced, they would trap another light entity in a body. They wouldn't harm animals. They were pescatarians. They would only eat certain fish, but they wouldn't eat any other animals. And usually people like this, right, the Cathars, they're usually wiped out. The Gnostics, they're usually wiped out, because obviously to the victor, the spoils. So we have a lot of, you know, history is a weird thing, but yeah, I can relate to that, where it's like, I was told, don't read the Book of Enoch, because you're going to get possessed.
Right.
It's like, well,
and, you know, just about angelic, you know? Yeah. But that's a trip.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because it paints a picture that is more otherworldly than the main. It's like the main story is already otherworldly. Throw this book in there and it's even crazier. Right. Yeah. And what are your, this is a fun question. What are your thoughts on aliens, bro? What do you think these things are?
Well, I think for me, like aliens, you know, Hermeticism always answered that for me, where it says as above, so below, you know, where it's kind of telling us that, you know, as within, so without, as the soul, so the universe. I believe that since there's intelligent life here, it would be irrational to believe that in the entirety of the universe that there's no aliens. You know, it's like saying there's fish in the Pacific Ocean, but the Atlantic are devoid of any life, and is the void, and then the Mediterranean, there's nothing there, but Pacific, we're all here, man. Like, you know, so to me, it's narcissistic, delusional.
Yeah. And I think that even maybe some religions have done that to us, right? They've made it to where they just focus on, I always joke around about this, but where some religions, they focus on living, preparing for the afterlife, that you're not living the actual life, like your life now here on Earth, because they degrade and they demean this reality, right? Because you're promised a better one. Like, I remember as a kid, like, you're gonna go to heaven, it's gonna be perfect, it's gonna be worship all the time, you're gonna have a mansion of gold, the streets are gonna be gold. It's like, wow, is this Atlantis?
You know? No, it's a lot, you know. There's some, all these books are amazing, because they can be read in different ways, different levels. Like, at least in the Torah, you know, people can go sod, peshut, where it's like secret, they're reading it in the secret ways, the Old Testament, or they're reading it in a more literal way, or they're reading it in some way that, I mean, I know that even they took a lot, there's a lot of verbiage from Jesus that the Gospel of Thomas, for example, that he wanted to be really understood forever. It's very similar to some Buddhist statements about, I think I remember every word of it. It's if kingdom is in the sky, the birds precede you. If kingdom is in the water, the fish precede you. Kingdom is within. And he was, Jesus was trying, Yeshua ben Yosef was trying to say, there is, if you, their kingdom is within you, and kind of what you were saying, like that consciousness within. So it's interesting how stuff, some stuff got taken out, and then some things got demonized, and even the female aspects of God that were in the really old faith of Yahwism, where, like, you know, where Yahweh was one of the gods in this, that all came from that stuff. And, you know, Ashura and all the, some of the female gods in the 10th century, I believe it was the 10th century, they started getting demonized or called names and stuff. But
yeah, or even mistranslated, they were actually women turned to men, etc., etc. Yeah. So I look at history as a big game of telephone, and I've always told people, right, I reserve my right. I do believe in Jesus Christ, I do believe in God, but I consider myself a scholar, I consider myself a researcher, so I'm going to look into these different things, and it's not going to sway me from my core beliefs, right? I think it was Aristotle that said it's the mark of an educated man to discuss things without believing them. And I think that, like you're saying, there's a lot of people who are literal. And I mean, dude, there's 45,000 different denominations of Christianity. I'm sure they'll be all right.
See, that's an example right there just of how, like, yeah, there's so many versions of it. It's that's why the mysticism is so important, or it all connects to, like, the Rosicrucian and Gnosis. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had another question for you here. So acting, well, let's first start out with your music, right?
Yeah.
Your days in, was it the Eyes of Noctum?
Yes.
What kind of genre is that? Because I am a guitarist. I've done a my fair share of headbanging, even though I don't have sweet hair like you in those days where you had the long hair, but I grew up listening. I think my first screamo band that I listened to was, because you and I aren't that much in age, you're 33, I'm 29, I'm about to be 30 next month, so we're kind of close there. So I had The Devil Wears Prada, Alisana, As Blood Runs Black, Shadows Fall, which is a little bit different, A Day to Remember, they're from Florida, and then I remember I progressed to something like more hardcore, Chelsea Grin, Suicide Silence, like that sort of stuff. And I grew up on that sort of music, and I was listening to your vocals, dude. They're sick.
Like, thank you so much.
What is it? What got you into music, and what ended up happening? You guys broke up. I know you put out a new song, The Wolf, which is also excellent. Can you talk to us a little bit about your music?
Of course, definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny, what I loved first is kind of what I'm coming back to, even in my metal music. And even in the extreme metal that I did, there was always a very spiritual kind of new age element to it. So, I mean, I started off with listening to Enya and a lot of music that came from different parts of the world. I would even have people ask me to name a country, and I would start playing the piano and start playing scales within the modality that country uses, or modalities the country uses. And I started just expanding more and more. And then after I got good at doing kind of like world ethnic music from all over, particularly Mediterranean and Middle East and India and the Scandinavia as well, I moved on to doing extreme metal. My first favorite band was System of a Down and Rammstein, but I went more to a extreme metal, you know, kind of more of a Behemoth, Cradle of Filth, Demon Warrior sound. The type of music I was doing in Eyes of Noctum was symphonic black metal. Then from there, I went into kind of a metal, new metal sound, which is where Wes Cage, the true music I've always wanted to do, is. And then you have songs like The Wolf that are very much so active rock and stadium friendly, that can connect with the whole world. No one feels like they're doing something illegal by, you know, like some of the black metal
What do you mean by that, Wes? Not, you said not doing something illegal. Was there stuff going on that was illegal during your eyes of Noctum? Like,
well, the nothing illegal was going on, but I do know that, you know, sometimes friends that I would show things to, like a friend of mine, he's no longer a friend of mine, but he was one of my buddies that was like into Christianity, Coptic Christian, so Egyptian. He was checking it out, and also a video from Behemoth, and he's like, "Oh, I feel bad for liking this," because he was so, you know, he was raised with being devout and with the light, and then there's all this dark imagery in the Behemoth video, which is Blackened's death metal. So they get into the subject of darkness and stuff. Anyway, he's like, "Oh, I feel bad for liking them," and I'd always laugh because some people, you know, there's a lot of people that don't want to admit that they like the sound, and then I'm thinking to myself, "There's Christian black metal. There's." You know, there's every version of it all, but yeah, I mean, you know, people would go to these concerts, and there were some people that were very much so kind of trying to do what happened with the first wave of black metal, or second wave rather, in Scandinavia and in England. I mean, like in you know, in Norway, there was some pretty severe activity. The government wanted to call it pagan extremism or pagan terrorism. I don't think that really a lot of people understood what was going on. There's, yeah, that's Eyes of Noctum right there. And then that's the new look for the wolf.
Would you say that they were calling it paganism? Why?
Well, I think what happened was the Euronymous and Varg Vikernes, I didn't know I was Norwegian when I went to Norway. I didn't know I was part Greek and part Norwegian. So I go to these places, feel this connection. I'm like, man, I love it here. I knew about the Italian, but I found out that there was like Italian, Swedish, Norwegian. Anyway, some of these guys in the 90s, early 90s, like 1993, some of them, there was about 50 arsons, I think, recorded. The churches were built on sacred.
Yes.
Pagan land, and I think some of these people knew that, and they wanted to burn it because they believed it was part of the Northern Crusade, where,
wow,
you know, Christianity came into the Baltic and the northern countries of Europe and started to kill these people and call them, you know, savages. It was very similar to what happened to in North America. So it just, they kind of adopted their Viking imagery more, and then they got into Satanism as a way to give the middle finger kind of to that influence, or I believe Lutheran, even, you know, they were against the Lutheran influence that's very dear to the Swedish and Norwegian people. And, you know, sometimes when I would go to Norway and people would hear I was doing black metal, or even when they would see my band, they were wondering, are we in a gang? Are we? And we're like, no, we're just doing an album from California. He's from Siberia. We're just here making an album, you know. But I think that black metal's intensity, you know, it's gangster rap and black metal definitely made the most frightening, I would say, effects on people, like to where they believe they're a part of a, you know, an organization. But
so it drew from the dark imagery in order to, or let's not call it dark, but pagan imagery to put forth their, I guess, heritage in a way, like their culture and that, but then it's construed as black and death because it is pagan.
Right. I mean, well, they get into the actual demonology. Some of these people get into demonology, both Semitic demonology and Nordic. There's bands that are getting into that are very versed in Christianity and knowing about demonology and angels and stuff, like Gabriel and, or Gabriel, rather, you know, all these names being mentioned of angels and stuff, like they're into that full mythos, and also philosophy. But, you know, the black metal stuff is just, it's interesting. It's very rebellious. It wants to empower the listener. Basically, like, there was demonization of a lot of holy beings like Pan, Gaia, Cernunnos, you know, that like starting to use the kind of like the kind of like sabbatic goats, earth creature, fawn energy.
Yeah.
Make it look like a devil in a way. And it's like, that's like the farthest thing from a devil since the most animals are innocent, you know, but it's like, it's interesting.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Animals, there's a difference between, right, the simulacra and simulation. Jean Baudrillard talks about the difference of animals, and animals aren't violent. They have territory. It's instinct. It's different. It's primal versus man, who seeks to destroy, capture, all for what? For self gain, and it's very weird, right? So
it is.
And you mentioned something, right? The idea of the horns, the devil, Cernunnos, Pan, Pan, panic, pandemonium, all that, all those feelings that come that have those words in those gods' names or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And Baphomet has always been, well, for one, Fulcanelli, which was an immortal alchemist, French alchemist for. I was going to say he was an immortal French alchemist for a while, but this figure in alchemy that said that Baphomet is actually a representation of the great work. So it is an amalgam, it's a representation of what you need to do to complete the magnum opus, right? And there's something about symbols that are able to extract feeling from somebody. And I want to talk about acting with you here and motion picture and all these things, but I want to focus for a little bit on the sound, because you're talking about that they use this music to invoke feelings in the listener. You said to empower them, but were they putting occult stuff and esoteric concepts in their music as a sort of ritual? How'd that work?
I mean, there's a couple different types. I always looked at it. If someone's going to get into black metal, there's the cosmic and anti-cosmic stuff. So there's some black metal that really is misanthropic and it hates humanity. And I don't like that kind of black metal. It doesn't speak to me, but there is one that is spiritual and kind of connected to being empowered and kind of like the black flame, you know, all these symbols and all this terminology, but like, and it gets into all, you know, philosophy and occult and, you know, esoterica, but the kind of stuff that's better is definitely with the lyrics that are kind of like God's Second Hand, a song I did where I'm talking about
song, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you. I wanted to mention the fall of Lucifer, but then show it reverse, saying whatever goes down can come up again, based off the aphorism that whatever goes up must come down. And I was thinking, because I was trying to inspire people with that kind of mentality, or, you know, a song that came later, Left Hand of God by Behemoth, that kind of brought up something similar, where it's like, this force is a part of God, I'm not into an opposer. And I think that, you know, I was talking to a very dear friend of mine, an impeccable director, a CFAC bar. I was talking to him yesterday. We're talking a little bit about, you know, spirituality and you know the difference of these forces. You know, how I've even mentioned how sometimes people who think they're doing something in the name of the light, they're actually doing something horrific, and you know, they're going against the light, they're becoming the other end, they're going so far left or right that they're wrapping around to the opposite. So, you know, case in point with like crusaders and stuff that decided to kill innocent people that were just worshiping trees and God, and then this is demonic, but we'll take the Christmas tree from them and we'll celebrate that. You know, it's just very, it's like, it saddens me that happened. Paganism to me, you know, I believe in both monotheistic and kind of polytheistic beliefs, because I believe it all came from one, that there's multiple, so it's kind of both in a way. But I just, you know, I think that we were all connected. We were all one people. Everyone was pagan at one point. And with some of the violence that we're seeing right now in West Asia, it makes me sad for I know that Abraham wouldn't have liked to have watched what's going on between the children he created, the Christian, the Muslim, the Jewish. You know, I don't think he would have liked that. I think the Baha'i are the only one that are not they're not fighting.
And it's interesting, right? Because we're talking about animals. Animals don't recognize those lines on the map that we put there. Like, we put those lines on that map, and now we're fighting over those lines. It's like animals don't care about your borders or anything like that. They just cross right over because, again, there's something about that. And part of paganism also was to have a structure in society where everyone contributed to that, to the community, I guess, right? And what's that one saying? It takes two people to make a kid, but a village to raise it, or something or other like that. Well,
I believe that 100%. Yeah,
I mean, you could really, right? You're a father, so it's like there's something about the love for a child that you can't describe. There's certain feelings in life that you can't describe, and the love for a child is one of those, right? True love, like it's a feeling you can't put words on it unless you experience it. You know,
absolutely.
And so this black metal, death metal, dark metal, is it at a certain cadence or a certain frequency that they put it out? What's the hertz? Do they put it at a certain hertz in order to, again, depending on which? It almost sounds like there's a left hand path and right hand path in this genre. Do they shift that in order to shift the movie? Because sound alchemy, in my opinion, is a true thing, and there's and it's interesting because they attribute Lucifer to being the first musician, right? He's one of the first musicians. You have a lot of different, what was that one jazz player, the deal with the devil at the crossroads, I forget his name, but anyways, you have all these myths with the idea of music, frequency, cymatics, where you're able to, and right, and we incorporate alchemy into it. You mentioned the Crusaders, well, the Templars. If you read Fulcanelli's The Mystery of the Cathedrals, he believed that the Templars had a secret. Now, the secret is, we don't know what the secret was, that's why it was a secret, right? But that they allegedly left the instructions on how to create the magnum opus on these cathedrals. Okay, somebody funded them. Where did the gold come from? Well, it came from alchemy. That's how they were able to create all these cathedrals. And then what they did was they go, okay, well, all the information is going to get wiped out. Well, what if we just inscribe it directly on these cathedrals, but only the initiated are going to know? And when people were going to these cathedrals, they were having divine experiences through the lights, through the sound, through the vibrations within these cathedrals, right? Cathedrals have organs and all these different things. So it was more of an experience for the regular person, of course, because they couldn't read, but they could look at images, right? Yeah. So in this genre, do they do that? Do they mess with the frequency to make someone feel a certain type of way?
I'm sure some bands have done it. I've done it just with, you know, certain frequencies if I'm trying to make someone feel more elevated, especially now outside that genre. What I do, I'm very much so into, you know, metaphysics, quantum physics, and of course sounds gets in that, the science of cymatics, as you were saying. And you know, I'll put frequencies in like 432 or 528. I get into solfeggio, different resonance for different effects. But
yeah, and you have, right, one of the Tetragrammaton, where it was reality was spoken into existence, right?
Exactly.
Speech. And John, right, the word becomes the flesh. Like, there's something about that, right? You get into the whole aspect of writing. Can you talk to us a little bit about your song The Wolf and what that's about?
Well, it's definitely The Wolf has one of the many mystical concepts I want to bring to people, mysticism that hopefully it doesn't mystify anyone, because it's all, you know, known information that everyone has. But the wolf gets into the dichotomy of the higher and lower self, that we all have within us, basically the force that, you know, there's one force in us that is capable of, you know, making tremendous, greatness occur in the world, and to engender another renaissance, or to do something fantastic, where there's another force in us too that's extremely negative. It's the polarity, and it can cause someone to never reach their dreams. And that exists in everybody, that dichotomy and polarity. So I kind of wanted to make a song about that and show a guy who left insanity and derealization, and you know, he becomes a personification of power, control, and wealth in health and abundance. You know, the guy that he was before was a very mercurial individual, but it shows the transformation in the music video. And I played both characters. One is struggling with drugs and alcohol, which luckily I am sober on a year and a half almost now.
Congrats.
But thank you so much. But so it was an intense video to do. And my fiance, thank God, she's a fashion designer and actual artist. She fits into the family so brilliantly, but she did my costumes.
Yeah, well, I like the way that you write the... You do portray the transmutation of the of the character within it, right? And you're showing the ups and downs. And I think that a lot of people can relate to this because life is ups and downs. And I think a lot of people can see and how you're saying the... I've heard you say before that you've always been more of a lone wolf growing up. And it's interesting because you went from being in a band to now doing an entire album by yourself. You played all of the instruments and all that. Did you do that because you didn't want to... The reason why my show is the Juan on Juan is because I can count on Juan to show up every single time. And you know what I'm saying? Like, we're born... What do they say? We're born alone and we die alone. So it's like... And again, I'm not saying it don't love family and stuff like that, but again, I can always count on myself to get something done. Is that why you did the approach with the new album, like everything by yourself?
Well, with that, I did it with Keith Wallen from Breaking Benjamin. And then I did the lyrics, and I had my piano with me, so we were able to come up with ideas, but he did a lot of the music. He recorded the guitar. I did the vocals and I did piano. Of course, Blasco, my manager, always puts his input, and he's a profound artist as well. So that, you know, we have a quite a team. But there's a record that I did called Prehistoric Technology, where I'm on the guitar. I'm also on multiple other instruments, mostly like bouzouki, sitar, bass, keyboard, and I did vocals. And then there's one album I did. It hasn't been released yet, but there's a couple songs that I want to release. I did with Ryan Green, where I played literally the drums, the bass, the guitar, the piano, vocals. I did literally every single thing. And when I would go home and I was supposed to go to sleep, I wouldn't. I would just go ahead and start making soundscapes and industrial tracks to go into the next day's session, bring a USB of what I did, and then go back to work. I mean, it was intense, and I want to release a lot of that album. There's some songs in there that are just... We always... Ryan and I think we did something very sacred. And what you're saying about Lone Wolf and stuff, you know, with that record, I did experience more creativity and kind of sacred moments. Like, I captured something direct from the source that didn't get dialed out by anyone's error in thinking or something like that. And so that was fascinating. But sometimes I do believe, you know, when you write with a partner or something like that too, just, you know, two people doing one thing, three people, not too many people, but you can start to tap into an energy together.
Especially someone you love, right? I mean, that's the whole thing.
Yeah. Like my fiance and I, when we write, you know, our scripts and stuff like that power is just, we're traveling to the same place, and it becomes way more powerful, you know, than being alone.
So, Wes, you've done music. Obviously, you've done acting. You come from a family of actors. You could kind of say that you're in the family business in a sort of way. I can relate to you. I work for my dad. You know, we work together, so I can know how difficult that can be sometimes, working with family and being in that position. Which do you enjoy more? Do you enjoy music? Do you enjoy acting? What is it that you enjoy the most? If you had to pick one thing to stick to it.
For me, the music and the acting comes from the same place. martial arts and the cooking and stuff, I think, is where I'm from going to a different area. But music and acting are identical for me with the enjoyment. Maybe sometimes in the filmmaking process, I'll get more enjoyment out of writing a script than I could if I'm not on a set where there's some riffing allowed. But if a director is really wanting me to put my input into it and then take his or her ideology and concept and to really access that, like, but they want to riff on it and do something really elevated, that's the most exciting for me. Even if it's just directly, you know, line for line, no improv, or improv, whichever way. But
we talked about alchemy, sound, the incorporation of colors even, right? Yeah. And one of the things I talk about a lot on this show is, right, you have sigil magic, which essentially are pictures, and right, motion picture essentially is that. And I call these people the sorcerers of the subconscious, because they're trying to sometimes write these archetypes, and they want to talk to people on a much deeper level. It involves memetics, right, and the forming of culture. And I call them cinemagicians. And one of the quotes that has always stood out to me by Francis Ford Coppola is, I think cinema, movies, and magic have always been closely associated. The very earliest people who made films were magicians. Now, we can take magicians as like stage magicians, magic with a C, or magic with a K, I believe, is also involved. And they're like Crowley, right? With the esoteric and the occult, because there is something to that. Because can you walk us a little bit how you do you, and again, do you invite something in? Do you step into something? How do you get into character? And how is the process? Like, does a director tell you be this way and you try to emulate however they're telling you to be? Or how does that work? What happens behind the scenes? We can't hear you, Wes. We lost your audio here. Let's see. Yeah, we lost you with the audio. I think maybe try getting out and then stepping back in. Yeah. All right, we'll wait for him to... I guess he had another alarm set off. He's been having alarms go off. And he had another one. So, yeah, but I'm just interested in seeing... and knowing about what happens behind the scenes when it comes to different actors and portraying these characters and how the magic happens, right? So let's see if we got you now.
There someone we go. Tried to call.
You're good.
That's that energy. Sometimes people, they can feel you and they'll call. Especially if I'm writing something really profound, deep conversation, I'm working on some kind of soundtrack and there's some really profound part, bam, the phone call comes in. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So I use a lot of psychology. I develop the idiosyncrasies of my character with the director, kind of ask questions. As soon as I have a kind of like a nice holographic image of who I'm playing, I'll really envision that character. I'll ask the character questions and they'll respond to me in my mind as I'm focusing. I'll even develop false memories as a character and not tell people what I was thinking of, just to make the character seem more real. And if you could pick up on something when you're watching it, it's different. But so I tap into that a lot. If I use some spiritual methods too, though. If I'm playing a character, like for instance, I played a character with my friend who called me, my brother Jesse. He played Lamel and I played Lieutenant Colonel Rudder in the movie D-Day, which was about the, Battle of Pointe du Hoc, part of the Omaha Beach situation, everything in Normandy and D-Day. When I did that character, I knew I was playing a real man, and he started off as a football coach. And he was a very paternal, powerful figure, and I knew that I was only 27, 28, but I wanted to look like a man that was a little bit more of a chief that had some wisdom. I completely transformed myself with meditation. I mean, I would go into a bath every night, saying things to the universe, asking actual ghost of that individual. Is it okay if I portray you? Please guide me in my steps so that I don't offend your family and your legacy, or my legacy, my lineage, my family. Can I please give you this character? And sure enough, I transformed. I started to talk a little bit like this, and I'd call people son on set that were older than me. Even though I was calling them son, they're like, okay, he can call us son because he looks 48, 50 kind of right now, even though I was not even 30 yet. But and I was meditating, and I did use some herbs to help relax my body and to look at all this dialogue and to know that I had to say all these commands perfectly, flank left, flank right, A team, B team, all these staff sergeants, all these different names, and I couldn't mess it up. I had to do that as a leader, and I was a captain in the wrestling team, so I did pull from my being a captain kind of, and being a person that's very, a lot of my friends would say when they're around me, I'm very encouraging, and I've tried to build people up positively with real info, but I've never been in combat before, of course, seen anyone, you know, never been in battle or did any tours, but I have been in hostile situations, but I pull from all that. And that was, that character was just very powerful. And I believe that I became him, and then I kind of walked away from that character. Sometimes when I'm done and I do a movie, if a character I become is a part of me that scares me at all, I will like bury an object or like a rock and say, that's the character. And I'm ejecting that character out of me, because I became a character in Assault on VA-33, where I played a character named Adrian Rybakov. That's where I developed the false memories. But he was he's a Russian terrorist that has a syndicate, pretty military, like a militia. This group is very powerful, and they all raid a hospital. And I'm just looking for my brother out of love. Everyone else is in it for the money. But when I played a character like that and start getting into the dark genius or anything like that, that can be a little frightening. So I had to definitely bury a rock after that in New York. I was in Buffalo, and I was like, I part ways with the character, but I take chosenone.com. Go visit chosenone.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. Chosenone.com. Go visit chosenone.com. The chosen one. Yes, he is the chosen one. He's got his own comic, and now he's got his own song. 'Cause he's the chosen one. Yes, he is the chosen one. Go buy a copy at chosenone.com. Chosenone.com. Go visit chosenone.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. Chosenone.com. Go visit chosenone.com. The wisdom, but I have to leave away the energy.
So aren't you afraid of something staying, Wes, if you invite something in? Because, right, ask and you shall receive. Mm-hmm. It's like maybe sometimes you'll receive an unwelcome guest, right, by doing that. Because you're right, there's evocation, invocation, and yeah, you're willingly, right? We're talking about the African cultures earlier before we start recording, and right, Vodun, voodoo comes from them. They're about invoking this deity entity into them, and they let themselves be used as a vessel in a sort of way.
That's the true shamanic acting too. Yes. That acting all came from. I mean, in every culture there was these spiritual elevated shamans that were the medicine, more important than the chief even, because everyone's wellness was attached to the shamans. But I know there's a way to do it, there's a very unsafe way of doing it. You know, if someone's really gonna do it the way they do in Siberia, where they're drinking vodka and then asking an energy to come into them, or like in voodoo where they do that too, voodoo, obeya, all that, they have to be very careful and know how to do it properly, like as detailed as a lawyer or a doctor that knows those rules and stuff. Because I'm heavily into, you know, mysticism and practicing practical magic and stuff, and I always take every caveat super seriously. You know, like I would never call in something, certain words, or, you know, certain words I know in Sumerian, for example, that are just, I've experimented with those. There, we've had a lot of paranormal properties in the family. You know, the second most haunted place in the world for a second.
Yeah.
So when I would bring friends over and everyone would have the same experience, even if that person was nihilistic, if that person was spiritual, that person had their hand in both. It just, when they saw that, it was hilarious. We asked someone that was in the band, since you don't believe in ghosts and everything, take a walk down the hallway over there. There's this hallway that looks just so intense. He's like, no, I can't. I'm like, why? You don't believe in anything though, right? You don't believe in the metaphysical and an energy. He's like, well, no, I don't. And I'm like, then why can't you walk down there? Because I can feel something. I'm like, what the fuck? Excuse me, what's that? I feel something. I'm like, yeah, that's because there's spiritual energy in there, man. And then, there's a force that he didn't want to connect with, but it wasn't that negative in that house. You know, that there was one force that was very intense, but a lot of positive. My bro Jesse, again, that I mentioned before, he was with me there, and we had a beautiful experience where we saw like orbs and stuff floating, beautiful blue orbs that were just there, and we took pictures, and we still have those.
You're talking about the LaLaurie Mansion? Is that the one that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the one.
And this is what really blows my mind when it comes to people who have zero belief. You have the people who are completely atheists, who don't believe in anything. And it's like, there are people, reality is, we don't even understand consciousness, to begin with. We don't even understand the nature of reality. And I believe that that reality is much deeper and more sophisticated than we are led to believe. Okay. And obviously we have God, right? But we do have, in my opinion, realities layered on top of one another. And you're talking about burying perhaps a talisman or something, an amulet of sorts, when you're done with a character, putting that character in that, doing a sort of ritual, if you will, and burying it to get rid of that and almost have some sort of closure. Well, in my opinion, architecture is the same thing. It can hold memories. There's something about wood. There's something about, I forgot what was the fact that they told me. They told me that when the electrical grid, right? Because I've seen you do also these Wild West movies, these cowboy movies. And I forgot who told me it was, something along the lines of when the electric grid was introduced, the amount of paranormal incidences went down or something like that. It was like something weird, almost like the electromagnetic frequencies suppressed that. But a lot of these old-time buildings were wood, right?
Yeah.
So there's something, in my opinion, of these places that hold these energies. And, right, you had a guy who was, what was he? He was an atheist and didn't believe in anything, but he wouldn't go down the... Yeah.
And whenever we would ask the question, he would say a real rational response that was always connected to metaphysical.
Yeah.
Like proving himself the truth. Literally, it's almost like he knew all along inside that it was true. But everything holds energy. That's why I'm huge about, you know, the specific incenses that I burn or make, or rose oil in water. If you make a little, if you just take like a spray bottle, or even buy the spray bottles that are empty and just ready for you to put whatever you want in there, a little bit of a safe rose oil in some rose water with water. If you spray that, that's like three times the strength of sage and Palo Santo. The rose is very powerful for removing negative vibes and stuff. You know, I'll sometimes wash my body in it. I really believe in it, rose oil and stuff. Some people I notice are into that too. I'll be walking around Southern California. I'll see people selling rose, Palo Santo, and sage tied together. I'm like, these people know exactly what they're doing, because they're giving you every missile for negative energy right there. And, you know, rose being the freaking most nuclear.
And how does it feel, right? The being related to Nick Cage, right? Obviously, he's your father. Being a Cage, has that helped you in your acting or your career, or has that hindered you a bit? What's that been like to be in the family with what I consider one of the greatest actors of all time, right? One of the most prolific actors of all time. And how is that? How was that growing up, having Nick Cage as a father?
Well, he's just always been a profound father. Our connection has been very powerful, always. We would connect on philosophy and mysticism, psychology, all kinds of stuff, science, you know, astronomy, acting, I mean, art, mostly philosophy. My fiance actually has a degree in philosophy, as well as her artistic certifications and stuff. But, you know, my dad and I would always, sometimes we would improv together. We would just create together, do a scene together. If we had like a 2 or 3 hour drive, we just improv together. And he was always realistic with me. He told me that when that day does come, when I start working and stuff, I'll notice that I might have to work 3 times harder than I thought I would have to, or maybe 10 times harder than my friends, because I'm coming into this and people have preconceived notions or beliefs. And I'm going to have to, be it positive or negative, I'm going to have to really show that I'm my own entity. So I got that picture very quick when I started dealing with abuse from acting instructors, when I go to acting school and stuff. That never happened in Stella Adler, which is my method. I do Stella Adler style acting, and the style that my dad has mentioned, and kind of my own style. I think everyone develops their own style. Everyone's a book, you know, you develop your own style throughout life, and whether you immortalize it by making a book about it or not. I'm working on a book, but my dad and I would always practice together our craft, and Stella Adler taught me a lot about, you know, the relaxation they get into with the imagination. I mean, I, of course, have implemented some stuff I've learned from hypnotism, which I'm into, psychology. You know, I make audios that are hypnotic for people, and I do that for myself. You know, I've made my own audios to develop a character or to program myself to be a certain way or something. I think that, and also my father is one of those individuals that's just infinitely intelligent. He's like my grandpa, August. I mean, that man was so intelligent that people described sometimes it was almost like scary for them, because he was like an encyclopedia. He knew everything. And I tried it with him when my grandpa was still alive, asking him a question that maybe someone couldn't answer. He really did know the specific eternal answer to that. I was like, what the? It was fascinating. But he invented this thing, and it's called a tactile dome. People can go see it in San Francisco, the tactile dome. It's just, I think it's at the observatory or something, something like that. But it's a sensory deprivation area that raises the IQ and stuff. It's fascinating.
You said the tactile dome here. Let's see here. Let's look it up. Where was it at?
San Francisco, made by Dr. August Coppola. My grandpa was a doctor at 21. He really took academia seriously.
Is it this one here?
Yes, that's the one.
So this is for, you said it's a sensory deprivation?
Yeah, and my apologies. I said at the observatory, that's Los Angeles. This is the exploratorium in San Francisco. So when you go inside there, it's completely tactile. It's giving you a connection to your haptic sensory. So it's all based off touch. The lights go off and you have to find your way out of the kind of maze. And what it does is it stimulates your other senses, being our hearing, of course, and our touch sensory, and maybe some other ones that we don't know about yet. But it's pretty fascinating. I mean, he wrote a lot of books, and you know, even my uncle Francis, my father, we all say how much he's inspired every one of us, and we're all emulating kind of a spark that came from him.
That could be kind of intimidating, right? Those are big shoes to fill.
Very big shoes, and he's a very, you know, every time I work with energy healers or the real true clairvoyants, I know there's a lot of people out there that aren't, but there really are the ones that are real. They see how close we are. We still raise the glass on February 16th because he doesn't feel dead at all, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I saw that your father said that he wasn't going to stop acting, right, anytime soon. So hopefully he does. And I just finished watching Dream Scenario, and I loved every second of it. It was an amazing, amazing movie. And yeah. I just love how dynamic Nick Cage is, right? And how versatile he is, right?
He has a lot of different layers. And like I've always said, you know, he's 1,000 years ahead of his time, where he's thinking mentally with some of these things. And we're both very into what we were talking about earlier about how some of the first actors were shamans. For me, art, there's certainly words that shows itself with its prefix, its seed, and the branches that word becomes, you know, with its origins, like the word art itself being in the word articulation, the first three letters of articulation. So to me, it's like art is the highest form of communication. And my dad's really into the message behind his characters, and so am I. I don't want to play characters that I don't resonate with or understand in some way. There's a character I had to play recently that's a kind of a hybridization of two people that really existed. And that person's someone I do not connect with at all, but I wanted to play that dark of a character. It's a movie I did with my fiance, with Mel Gibson and 50 Cent. That movie will make a lot of people, especially young ladies, be extra careful in the world. You know, there's some predator evil individuals that are very frightening. And I've seen some pretty dark individuals. Like, I've seen insanity, you know, with what I grew up in. I've seen some scary folks out there. So I was able to pull from some memories of mine. And, you know, hopefully this character will make people more circumspect and careful. And that's whenever I play a villain, I want to show with that villain's dark side, something so dark that maybe it's not appealing. People don't find it cool at all, and they want to stay away from that. That's kind of, you know, my character I did in Assault BA-33, he didn't have that kind of true, he was very angry, and he was a warrior, and he did things the wrong way. You know, you can't invade it. You can't go into a hospital and take hostages. That's messed up. He was doing stuff the wrong way. A displaced warrior, whereas this character really, you know, I believe serial killers, I believe rapists, I believe all these people, they're parasites. It's something that needs to be, yes, you know, edited out of our people. We got to find a way to edit it out of our humans, the human race. We have to all come together and edit that out with spirituality and help people fix their trauma, because the other way of doing it would suck, where if we had to get in there with, you know, technology and actually start to play God with what we're creating, that would be really messed up to edit certain mentalities out of humanity. But I mean, you know, there's certain things that do have to stop. You know, the fact that these guys out there did these things, and there's just a certain cruelty that I don't like in the world. And that it's interesting that led me to martial arts, my martial arts kind of life. You know, it all came from I hate violence, so I want to know every single dynamic of martial arts. And of course, I think martial arts goes into discipline, it goes beyond violence. But I when I'm doing what I practice now for like 10 years, I've been doing the more self-defense battlefield grade stuff. It's not beautiful or artistic in any way. It's scientific and clinical and horrible and stuff you would never want to have to use. But when I get into that, I'm only into that because I really believe that everyone needs to protect their body like a temple. And if someone's trying to hurt you, that's such a statement and a violation that soul is trying to inflict pain on another soul and dominate their will. That has to be, we have to learn how to protect ourselves in like third party defense, where you protect a relative or a friend, family, knowing how to do that. I never knew how to, the real way of doing that. Like, there's certain moves where you push the person you're trying to protect aside and then throw a kick. And it's like, it's interesting, but
That's yeah. Why I told you I wanted to learn jiu-jitsu to be able to, because I'm in Florida, bro, so we carry all the time. It's different, but yeah, it's like, what if you don't have that, right? What are you going to do? And a lot of these practices, they use leverage, they use that energy, they take that energy and you see it, they transmute it. Like, I love watching old, like, Bruce Lee videos of actual martial, and it was amazing, right? The way they're able to take that energy and turn it around on itself, or even any of the Gracies, like, right, watching them, they're so limber and flexible, and it's like, wow, this dude's gonna tap from that, and they don't. Like, they don't.
And it's amazing. I mean, that, so Bruce Lee, I was talking about him yesterday when I was at the film post with my friends, Asif, everyone, we were all talking. Bruce Lee was really, truly a scientific and spiritual genius. I mean, he had a high IQ, high SQ, high BQ, EQ. He knew, I mean, he was one of the godfathers of it all. And that system, Jeet Kune Do, how he made a theatrical but then practical version of it. So you're the one you can use on a movie set and then one you can use in actual combat. And some of those moves that he developed are very, 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 they're perfect. They're perfect concepts of telegraphing your knee with lifting your leg up a little bit, and then the guy looks down, you're coming with a back knuckle, like that kind of stuff. I mean, he was clearly tapping into something amazing. I call those people solar flare individuals, kind of like Bruce Lee, Hendrix, Brando in his own way. There's so many philosophers or people that we never met, maybe Alexander or something, you know. These people tap into something. It's very powerful. That's why I believe in being centered and not going too far into anything, but like to being like centered always. Cause I've had many spiritual awakenings, and I've had spiritual awakenings that were not successful. And that was scary to for people to see, for me to be around, for them to be around. Like when I did a Kundalini awakening, and then I didn't, no one looks at this. There's all these yoga places, and there's all these gurus online, thousands of them, saying if you access Kundalini without a guru is dangerous, and they're all telling the truth, and no one listens. If they're some of these people are trying to activate themselves and awaken, and it's like, maybe that's not a good idea to do right now when you're doing stunt driving or something. I don't know, you know, it's like people have to kind of stay more balanced.
The imagination, right, and memory, that's something that's always, right, anima, right, animism. You have Carl Jung that talks about the anima. You have the collective conscious, the unconscious, the subconscious, whatever you want to refer to it as. Do you use any memory techniques in your work? And if so, can you share some of those techniques with us?
Of course. One of the best memory techniques I've ever used was devised by Shakespeare, which I think he's also one of those individuals that are just, you know, true polymath, brilliant. It's called the loci method, and I use it for memorization of my lines. Also, if I want to make a memory anchor, I call them, I kind of like expand a little bit upon it. Like, you know, like when you want to shut the stove off or try and remember if you place something that's perfect location, and then you're wondering, did I do that right? And then you're kind of like forgetting, and there's an anxiety of, oh shoot, did I do it or not? I'll make little memory markers, like I'll remember a green triangle or something when I do something, and then when I'm driving or doing something, I'm like, oh, did I do that? Bam, that triangle comes up and I remembered it. So that's kind of the same method, loci method, where the memory technique is, let's say you have your lines in front of you and no one would have any trouble remembering to be or not to be, for example, I would hope. And you imagine the number two, then letter B, and then you can remember like a shoelace knot, and then let number two, and then B, and you kind of remember the graphics of it, or just remember the graphics of what your character is saying, and you'll see how you actually really take a photographic print of that, what you looked at, and it just comes right out. If there's any, and it's interesting how confidence is so connected to it. If someone's intimidated, and some roles will intimidate us, and there's a role, there's a scene where maybe you're even doing a speech. So it's like doing a speech already, being in a scene, plus you're doing a speech within the scene to people watching. You have to be so calm to remember all this stuff and to really visualize if the person's saying, I did a character once, they did a monologue, they just wrote it immediately, and they're like, can you get this in 5 minutes? I said, sure, I'll try. And I looked and we got it because my character was talking about 2 kilograms of something illegal. He was a dangerous character. So I thought to myself, all right, I'll imagine 2 keys, the actual keys for opening doors. And I remembered that and just came right up, you know, the, So really getting the graphics of what you're trying to say, and that's how you remember it in a three-dimensional way.
Yeah, I've used the memory palace technique before, where you create the rooms and you fill them up with whatever it is that you're trying to remember. And the wackier, the better, because it's easier to remember.
It is.
You know? And 100%. When you're acting, Wes, like in front of when you're on a set, how many people can be looking at you at one time?
Well, if you're doing your scene, you know, like we did a movie in Arkansas, my fiance and I, and we're all working to get perfect driving. I was doing some stunt driving in a movie before that, but this wasn't really stunt driving. It was just more accuracy and stuff. I mean, the whole entire crew and cast, everyone's looking through the monitors, and so many people are watching the car, making sure it's going to the same place. And so you can have 30 people looking at you. I mean, you can have, you know, some scenes where, you know, the director's not by the monitor. I know Werner Herzog likes to step away from the monitor. So it can be a lot, including the thespians you're working with. But, you know, I have always, when I do my scenes, I really just try to make sure that I do a memory palace, like you were just talking about. Like, I know what the scene looks like and everything needs to be completed in the blocking, what one is and what my last mark is, what the last line, and these everyone I'm working with, these individuals, their physical or mental or verbal cues of when I'm supposed to do something. So the end of certain lines to know when I have to go in and what's being done in a palace. That, especially auditions, if you go in there and you have a room that you're going to build and you actually just build that in front of everyone and then walk out after saying something really polite and memorable, they're going to be like, okay, who's that guy? And they're going to try to, because it's just like NCIS. I did that. I played a really scary British character that was like, you know, just the guy that came in my mind. It was just a download of a universe of some tough British guy that someone could hit him with a champagne bottle and the bottle would just break. And he'd be like, nice going, man. That's a nice one, lad. You know, it was very like intense. And I knew everyone was going to go in to play a Russian character. And I speak pretty good Russian, and I played that Russian character, but there was a guy from Moscow that was against me, you know, and I knew this guy is going in for Russian. They're going to give him the real thing. So I became the big British pit bull, you know, like scary character, and bam, I landed it. And I built that room in there. I had his voice perfectly. I showed it to friends even, and they asked me to come in again, and bam, I was on NCIS with LL Cool J doing that, you know, and Andrea Bordeaux, all those amazing people. I mean, Suzanne Saltz, that was a great team, and it was fun. You know, TV is a different pace than, and I think that would make me, I don't know how many relatives I have that have done TV shows. I think they try to, there's been a couple limited things, but I'm trying to, the script I'm writing is TV, you know, so I'm just, it's more eternal.
Yeah. And I also saw that you did a comic book with your dad too, a while ago, right?
Yeah. And that one I really want to have happen in some way, even if we have to do that fully animated, it's fine. You know, cause it's just what it gets into voodoo and, oh,
so amazing. I have this series called The Chosen Juan, and yeah. Right. I'd love to send you a copy, Wes. And I have some other stuff too here that I have.
Against the Saturn cube? Saturnine?
Yeah, the Saturnian cube.
Love that, man. You're really into this. Yeah, I love that. That's
and,
awesome.
And I have the homunculus owner's manual too. I don't know if you know what a homunculus is, Wes. Do you know what a homunculus is?
I'm looking at it, trying to dissect it based on.
No, don't look Greek. At that. That's.
Oh. But, homunculus.
Yeah, homunculus. I'll send you some. If you got a P.O. box, I'll send you the goodies and you can read through what an alchemical homunculus is. And
reminds me of like a manticore or something.
It's an artificially created being through the use of alchemy.
There we go. Like
so,
the, yeah.
A small man, miniature human, homunculus.
Yeah. And that's why I was with mom and I knew it was, there was a, yeah.
So that's yeah, I actually ordered a copy of the one that comes, it came together in the, so you say you wanted to make a TV show out of that comic book?
We tried, you know, we did. And it, I have actual scripts made for that. And it almost happened so many times. All of 2021 was me working on that, delegating that. But You know, I think it needs to happen. You know, the Voodoo Child is like an angel of voodoo. He's someone that got resurrected after a terrible thing happened to his abolitionist father by a horrific organization. And he is told by a voodoo priest to set the world straight and to never rest until the world is set straight. So to pretty much annihilate evil in a dark way as well. And he, you know, it's intense. It's definitely one of my favorite characters is Spawn, and it's in that Spawn Batman kind of realm. Maybe if you wanted to go Marvel, a character that would be as dark as him would be like maybe kind of like a Nightcrawler, because he looks like a zombie. He looks like a chimerical being that's of some kind of Saturnine background, but he's good. And Ghost Rider's like that. I like characters that use their darkness for good, because I feel like that's my superpower. I was always aware of how dangerous the world could be. I was always very empathic. When I was a kid, I even started crying in Greece because I felt this guy's sadness next to me. So when I started picking up on dangerous people, I kind of like started tapping into being... It's almost like if you see rage, instead of running away from rage, to overpower the rage with the more intense, like it was what I was into. And that's why I got into such aggressive music, heavy metal, like extreme metal, black metal. But you know, it was beautiful. My dad played Ghost Rider, and I saw how that manifested, and I saw him dress up in Halloween as Ghost Rider once, and how it was meant to be. And then I wound up doing voice work for the character, you know, and they needed some really intense growling stuff. And this was funny. I went into the studio and they wanted something demonic and scary. So I gave him ancient, you know, Hebrew, Greek. I gave him like all these old, you know, Norse. I gave him like ancient indigenous languages from North America, South America. I gave him all this stuff. And afterwards they actually, I believe, were trying to get ready to sage the room because they were worried that I had brought in something. Maybe we did, but that character, you know, when they were like, "What are you speaking?" And they're like, "Why does he know ancient Egyptian? It's a dead language." I was like, no, it's not.
That's you broke out the grimoires. I heard you say one time that as a kid you'd read these books that your father had laying around, some books on the occult and mysticism. Did he have books on the occult? Do you remember any of those books, what they were?
We've shared books and just from philosophers that are fascinating, Israel Regardi, like the book Garden of Pomegranates, people who are into just mysticism and of course following the light. And you know, I have original books from Aleister Crowley, actual ones from the 60s. And I think I have a couple of books from the 20s that are very powerful. I mean, you know, the mathematics of the book and what it teaches you how to do. And if there's a couple pages of these books, especially I noticed with magic in theory and practice, some of these things just don't make sense to the eye immediately. And then you start seeing how the numbers and numerology, all this stuff connects together. And then you start getting them, like, and then you start applying it. But you know, we would talk about all this stuff, like, you know, for example, with Christianity, mysticism and Christianity, how a cross, if you were to make a cross with paper and fold it all together, it would become a cube. And it's kind of gets into that fourth dimension, the cubic space, the different dimensions. And like you were saying with reality, I believe it's a matrix of parallel dimensions that are all different. We're of course in the one of cause and effect, but there's other ones in fourth dimension. I really believe fifth dimension is where you have that consciousness and light. But back to animism, like basically we're just in an animation of existence and force. I mean, there's an energy, and then this energy is so powerful that made the universe, that matter started to materialize out of the energy. And that's what's really fascinating to me, is when I really focus and meditate and I actually do my 26 minutes a day or fast for 7 days straight safely, I tap into this and I really think about how, yeah, this world that we're in, this is just it's intent, the materialization of intent, something intended for the universe to have kind of a centrifugal vibe going on where everything's spinning and you have the sun and, you know, there's this solar system. Just the fact that it's a system shows that there is an intelligent attempt and intention, and it all forms. Yeah, that's why with the alien stuff, you know, like, that's why I was so huge into, I've studied as much as I can of the Earth. My first favorite little, it wasn't even a toy, it was a globe where I could touch areas and remember.
Some people think it's flat, Wes. What do you think it's flat? You think it's a globe?
Definitely not flat. That concerns me when people think it's, yeah. Because of the geometrics, it's light being on one side of the Earth with the other one, you know,
it's a
being...
pizza box, bro. It's flat. It's a pancake floating through space. Yeah. Like, that's what they, yeah. And I really loved your dad in The Color Out of Space, right? The Lovecraft movie. I think Tommy Chong was in that one, I think it was. And the Lovecraftian aspects of the Cthulhu mythos that is used by certain occult groups. And that's why acting and all this memory, the Mundus Imaginalis, that all interests me, because I think we're tapping into another dimension, how you're talking about, like, right, the cube, and the interdimensionalism of that, and the Tesseract, right? You have with Hinton with the Tesseract and the idea of other realms, and the Theosophical Society took that and they formed their own ideas behind that, right? The astral planes and all these different other realities in which they could. Have you ever done any astral projection, Wes?
I've worked with astral projection once in England, and I did it with an astral projection. It's a non-psychoactive smoke blend that preps you for that spiritually. So it wasn't hallucinating or anything or tripping on like peyote or like ayahuasca, but I astral projected, and I've always noticed whenever that's happened to me, I come back tired. That's why a lot of friends of mine who do it on purpose, they'll take a 3 mile run afterwards, you know, just to get it out of their system. The kind of fatigue you wake up with from those projections, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely connect with these dimensions, and I think meditation is one of the best ways to just always be aligned with that consciousness.
Well, Wes, do you have any final thoughts as we close out the show here towards the ending? Do you have anything else you want to leave the listeners with? Any thoughts of wisdom or any upcoming projects or anything you want to leave the listeners with?
Definitely, yeah. I guess with animism, just to know that spirit is the first element. Even people say there's these four elements, and the pentacle is not a satanic thing. It's the five elements, spirit being the first, the master, one of them all. You know, the spirit is a true element, and I think that, you know, magic in its most basic form is life and the desire to expand, to grow. There's quite a lot of magic. So I believe that maybe one day, as time goes on, I can help the world and do what I'm meant to do. And part of that is to bring, I really believe I have a goal, and my vision is not just for me and to make sure my family is first, of course, but like everyone should be. But I believe that there could be another renaissance. I think there could be another age where certain more elevated spiritual realizations and concepts are more accepted. Everyone's kind of understood on that. There's meditations in school. There's the science, spirituality, art, and everything else being connected in a way that never has before. So like one of the ways that, you know, with the Renaissance, like that, there wasn't that much violence going on during the Renaissance. And I think beautiful things would happen if people on the whole world tried to make another one of those Renaissances and, you know, do something profound. I think I want to elevate humanity. And that's why these books are going to be, you know, so interesting, I think. And I think we all have wisdom within us. We're all encoded and programmed in some way that's to be something profound, and we can always tap into our higher self. you know.
Tao Plato says, we know everything already. We just have to remember.
Right? Exactly.
We just have to tap into that. So, again, that's why I find this all fascinating. And the reason I asked you how many people were watch you when you do these lines, because I was thinking, I have this thing coming up soon where I was thinking about taking a shot at stand-up comedy for the first time ever. But here's the thing. I have a show that right now thousands of people will listen to this, Wes. You know, there's going to be a thousand people who are going to listen to this. I have zero problems with that. It doesn't bother me right now. I can do a live show. I've had 2,000 people watch me live on a computer.
Yeah.
But in person, it's a whole different animal.
Yeah. Oh, man. I felt that at the Palms with that show we did with the West Cage show when there was that was a huge in the Pearl Room. That was a huge turnout. And when there's a lot of people in one room, it gets pretty divine. I mean, if it's all done properly.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I feel with putting out works like my comic book and my podcast, and this is my art. This is how I express myself. With so many people interacting with my work, I have a heightened sense of synchronicity sometimes, like heightened incidences of synchronicities, and it's almost like it's too good to be true sometimes. And it's like, well, how many times does it has to happen for it to just be a coincidence or an actual phenomenon, right? Like, when are you going to start to realize it? And that's what I love about synchronicity, is like you can either ignore them or you can take them for what they are and take them as I love synchronicities, or even deja vu. I think that it's reality in life leaving you breadcrumbs, like, hey, you're on the right track. Like, I've been here before. Like, some part of me has been here before. Therefore, I know I opened all the right doors. I know I took all the right turns. I knew I did everything right because I've already been here before. Right.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Wes, dude, you killed it. Really enjoyed our conversation. Hopefully you'll come back on again. And
absolutely.
Yeah, dude. So anything you want to leave the listeners with, a plug your stuff for one time at Weston Cage? Yeah.
Definitely. Check out my Instagram. It's a sanctuary of a lot of creativity, and it keeps you in touch with what I'm doing. Also, I get into some comedy on there too, with some abstract humor. So that's at Weston Cage Coppola. And then there's a www.westcageemporium. That's where I still kind of release some of my, I do work with frequencies a lot. Those audios I make are really potent. I use them myself. And then I make like talismans and stuff and do these. Well, there's a lot of film work coming up. I heard from everyone that there's going to be a theatrical release to one of the films I did. That's with my fiance and a Seafuck bar. And we're just looking forward to that.
When can we expect the book? Do you have a date for that yet? Or is that still in the works?
It should be. By the end of this year, I should have everything. It's a shorter read, the first one, everything done, and then I'm going to release that probably 2026.
Okay, and then any upcoming projects that are going to be recent? I'm going to put this out next week, so it'll be fresh in people's. You have any projects that are coming out anytime soon or still in post-production type of stuff?
We have that film that we did with my fiance, a Seafuck bar, Mel Gibson, 50 Cent, called Boneyard.
Boneyard.
I also did a movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme, my friend James Colin Bresic, incredible director, called Darkness of Man. There's that Western I did. I kind of forgot it about it, though. Then after that, there's also Crescent City, which we did in Arkansas.
Cool. I'll keep an eye out for those. I wrote those down so I can check them out and make sure to post all your links in the description. Wes, thank you again, bro. Really appreciate you, dude. And yeah, stick around. I'll get your PO box so I can send you a couple copies of The Chosen Juan. Everyone, make sure to go follow Wes. Make sure to check out the show, tjojp.com, chosenjuan.com. Sign up for the Kickstarter of The Chosen Juan Issue 2 and get your Homunculus Owner's Manual, all that good stuff. Appreciate everybody. And as always, catch you on the next one.
Blessed be. Thank you, brother.